The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Library. The stories of the men and women of the United States Armed Services and their role in the preservation of democracy are explored here by leading military historians, scholars, and authors. This is the Pritzker Military Library Presents.
Welcome to the Pritzker Military Library Presents with our special guest, Thomas Fleming. I'm your host, Ken Clark. This programming is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Library in downtown Chicago and is made possible by members of the library. Later on, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience and from those of you joining us on the internet at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Thomas Fleming is a distinguished historian and author of more than 40 books, including several bestsellers, a frequent guest on PBS, A&E, and the History Channel. Fleming has contributed articles on American heritage, History Today, and many other publications. He has served as president of the Society of American Historians and spent 10 years as chairman of the New York American Revolutionary War Table. He joins us tonight to discuss his new book, A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Library, Thomas Fleming.
Thank you very much. Good evening. What a great pleasure it is to be here in Chicago and get a chance to talk to you about what I really think is the most important book I've written yet. Let's start with a phrase. The words leaped into my head many years ago as I was writing a book about the Louisiana Purchase. Thomas Jefferson's nightmare. I had no idea that I was naming a disease in the public mind. I came upon this phrase a few years later while writing an article about John Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia. At that point, most of my history books had been about the era of the American Revolution. Brown was new historical territory for me. I was startled to discover that this gray-bearded 59-year-old planned to take command of an army of slaves equipped with the 100,000 rifles in the federal arsenal at the ferry, as the town was called. In Brown's luggage were carefully drawn maps identifying the counties of the South where blacks outnumbered whites. These were his targets. Equally surprising was the discovery that Captain Brown, as he called himself, was defeated and captured by U.S. Marines led by Colonel Robert E. Lee, the most famous soldier in the American Army of that time. At Brown's headquarters in nearby Maryland, Lee found letters that revealed six wealthy Northerners had armed Brown and his men with the Sharps rifles that killed innocent citizens in Harper's Ferry, including the town's mayor and a free black man, one of the first of the many ironies in the Civil War. Brown's subsequent trial and execution stirred violent emotions, North and South. President James Buchanan blamed the uproar on a disease in the public mind. I could not get that phrase out of my head. What did it mean? I soon discovered that the concept of the public mind had a long and respectable history. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and many other leaders used it when discussing politics. At one point, Washington lamented that Patrick Henry's opposition to his presidency had soured the public mind of Virginia. Lincoln said Southerners had debauched the public mind to convince people that secession was legal. In the 1952 presidential election, the Democratic candidate, the former governor of Illinois, Adlai Stevenson, said those who corrupt the public mind are just as evil as those who steal from the public. The term public mind describes something much less fluctuating than public opinion. That can change as swiftly as the weather. The public mind involved fixed beliefs that were fundamental to the way people saw the world of their time. A disease in the public mind was, and is, because we've got a few today, a twisted interpretation of political or economic or spiritual realities that seizes control of thousands and even millions of people. Americans first experienced one of these episodes in 1692 when the leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony became convinced that witches were threatening their society with evil powers. Over 200 people were arrested and flung into fetid jails. 21 were hanged. One 71-year-old man was pressed to death beneath heavy stones. No one described this frenzy better than the great New England novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne. That terrible delusion should teach us, among its other morals, that the influential classes are fully liable to all the passionate error that has ever characterized the maddest mob. Clergymen, judges, statesmen, the wisest, calmest, holiest persons of their day stood in the inner circle round about the gallows, loudest to acclaim the work of blood, last to confess themselves miserably deceived. John Brown stirred similar unreality in the Best People of the North in 1859. They showered praise on a man who believed, and I quote, that without the emission of blood, there is no forgiveness for sin. In Kansas, a few years earlier, Brown had murdered 6 unarmed Southerners before the horrified eyes of their wives and children, and ordered his sons to hack up their bodies with swords. After Brown's execution, America's best-known writer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, declared him the equal of Jesus Christ. Another Massachusetts man told Emerson that compared to John Brown, Christ was a dead failure. He had ignored 3 decades of Northern prayers begging him to end slavery. John Albion Andrew, the governor of Massachusetts, declared the South had to be conquered, though it cost 1 million lives. The governor's war cry became a blood-soaked prophecy. The Civil War caused more deaths, more heartbreak, than our nation suffered in all its other wars. It created what one historian has called the Republic of Suffering, a tidal wave of grief and loss that tormented the nation for the rest of the 19th century. Even more shocking to me was the realization that the United States was the only country in the world that fought such a horrendous war to end slavery. All the countries of South America, even Brazil, which had 3 million slaves, almost as many as America's 4 million, ended the evil institution peacefully. The British freed almost 1 million slaves in the West Indies without bloodshed. Revolutionary France ended slavery in their colonies with a decree from Paris. How could this avalanche of death happen in the United States of America, founded by men and women who believed in freedom and equality and had legislatures and governors and a president supposedly elected to respond to the voice or voices of the people? To answer this question became the goal of the book I decided to write. Soon I had chapter after chapter about Americans who struggled with the dilemma of slavery. One of the most touching was the story of John Woolman, the New Jersey Quaker, who urged the Americans of 1750, 25 years before the Revolution, he urged them to end the slave trade and find a way to peacefully free its victims. He didn't blame anyone for slavery. Woolman was an intelligent man. He knew that this horrible thing had existed for 2,000 years. He simply tried to tell slave owners why inhuman bondage troubled him so deeply. In his later years, John Woolman wore white clothing. He refused to use dyes made from indigo, harvested by slave labor in the West Indies. He went to England, where his bizarre appearance prompted one leading Quaker, a prominent physician, to suggest he should go home as quickly as possible. After Woolman calmly explained his mission, the doctor apologized for his rudeness. A few months later, John Woolman died of smallpox in northern England, apparently an eccentric failure. But his journal, reprinted dozens of times, became the seed that inspired a future generation of Britons to free 1 million West Indian slaves peacefully by paying their owners $1 billion. Another chapter is one of my biggest surprises. It's about George Washington. In 1775, he was impressed by the numerous black men who told him they wanted to fight for America's independence. General Washington accepted them in the Continental Army. Soon he was accepting whole regiments of black men. By the end of the Revolutionary War, one in every seven men in the American ranks was black. These soldiers were only a tiny percentage of the 300,000 black Americans who remained in bondage in 1776. The man who awoke Washington to the moral dimension of their hard fate was the idealistic French volunteer, the Marquis de Lafayette. The childless Washington grew very fond of this young man who called himself, his adopted father. More than once, Lafayette told him that he would never have drawn his sword if he had known he was helping to found a republic of slavery. Soon Washington began recognizing the legitimacy of slave marriages at Mount Vernon. He made capable black men overseers of several of his farms and rewarded them for doing a good job. During his presidency, he seriously considered giving freedom to all his slaves and calling on other Americans to imitate his example. But angry political divisions about other matters made him fear a quarrel over slavery would rupture that fraternal affection that Washington considered the binding force between the North and the South. And this it would destroy the still very fragile American Union. Instead, Washington tried to set an example. He freed all his slaves in his will and ordered each man and woman to be educated and trained in a skill that would enable them to live respectable lives. We should pause here and realize what a remarkable thing this was for a slave owner to do in 1799. Most Southerners at this point, A, did not think that blacks could be trained or in a skill or taught to read, and quite a large number of them thought that they shouldn't be trained that way. Alas, the shock of Washington's sudden death in the last month of the century, this totally obscured his lonely emancipation. And I emphasize the loneliness. He couldn't persuade his own wife or all the members of his own family to agree with him. His emancipation went largely unnoticed, and I decided to call Washington in the book A Forgotten Emancipator. Two other chapters explore Thomas Jefferson, whose passionate detestation of slavery shines through the Declaration of Independence. But this emotion was tragically corrupted by Jefferson's conviction that blacks were inferior to whites and nourished resentments that would make it dangerous to freedom. I describe Jefferson as slavery's greatest foe. There's no doubt that that's true. And also its unintended friend. In 1801, soon after he became president, slavery's unintended friend, his emotion, his detestation of slavery, was tragically corrupted by his conviction that blacks were inferior to whites and nourished resentments that would make it dangerous to freedom. In 1801, soon after he became president, a French diplomat persuaded Jefferson to approve an invasion of the island of Santo Domingo. The new ruler of France, Napoleon Bonaparte, wanted to regain control of the French half of the island to reap the profits of its fertile soil. It was once the most valuable overseas possession that France possessed. It was currently being governed by a gifted former slave, Toussaint Louverture. A tiny buzzing creature, the female mosquito, whose bite inflicted yellow fever, destroyed the French army after a year of vicious no-quarter warfare. An enraged black man, General Jean-Jacques Dessalines, marched his army across the island and killed every surviving French white man, woman, and child. Then he declared himself the leader of a new country, Haiti. This was Thomas Jefferson's nightmare, a race war. The appalled president persuaded Congress to pass a resolution refusing to recognize Haiti's independence and barring all political contact with the new black nation. For the next 58 years, the United States tried to pretend that Haiti did not exist. But reports of the extermination of the white population permeated the public mind of the American South. I should add here that the French white people were the ones that Dessalines killed. He spared Americans and other people who were on the island at the time. It was France at which the man was enraged, although there was no doubt that this was a race war that he waged against white French men, women, and children. When John Brown's wealthy northern backers learned that, when John Brown's wealthy northern backers were revealed, numerous southern leaders declared, "These people want to inflict another Santo Domingo on us." It was by no means the first time Southerners had used these words. This report of the extermination of the white population of Haiti had permeated the public mind of the American South. And those words in the wake of John Brown reveal that this fear of a race war had persisted in their public mind for more than a half century. In the meantime, President Jefferson unintentionally launched another disease of the public mind in the North. After the failure of the invasion of Santo Domingo, Napoleon abandoned his plan to restore the French Empire in America. He sold the immense territory of Louisiana, almost a third of the continent, to the United States. New England's leaders objected angrily to the Louisiana purchase. They foresaw that this huge expansion would reduce their section of the nation to a minority. They were outraged. They were the people who had begun the American Revolution. They regarded themselves as the nation's rightful leaders. 3 years later came President Jefferson's embargo. To avoid war with an aggressive England, which was locked in a life and death struggle with Napoleon's France, Jefferson prohibited all trade with both nations. The embargo had a catastrophic impact on New England, whose ships carried most of America's cargo. Merchants went bankrupt by the dozen. 40,000 unemployed sailors seethed and rioted in her ports. The already angry New Englanders began to see Southerners as arrogant, uncaring enemies instead of fellow Americans. Goodbye to George Washington's fraternal affection. The depth of this antagonism became vividly evident in the War of 1812. The New England states did everything in their power to cripple President James Madison, the Virginian in the White House. They refused to let their state militias serve in the U.S. Army. They openly traded with the enemy. Finally, they called a convention in Hartford, Connecticut, to discuss seceding from the Union. The war ended before New England could make good on this threat. But peace did nothing to moderate their animosity toward the South. Their hostility soon focused on the South's moral flaw, the persistence and even the growth of slavery as cotton became a hugely profitable crop. New Englanders began challenging the admission of new states that tolerated slavery. In 1819, a dispute over Missouri brought the federal government to a virtual halt and elicited a cry from the 76-year-old Jefferson, "We have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor let him go." He was still in the grip of his race nightmare. A decade later, a Boston newspaper man named William Lloyd Garrison began publishing The Liberator, a paper that called for the immediate emancipation of all the South's slaves. Hatred for the South was deep in Garrison's soul. Jefferson's embargo had bankrupted his merchant sailor father and destroyed his parents' marriage. Garrison combined his call for instant emancipation with the assertion that slavery was the equivalent of rape, a crime he accused slave owners of constantly committing. Garrison claimed he was inspired by God to take this stance. Slavery itself was a sin. Wasn't it logical that it would be the fountainhead of other sins? Soon, numerous New Englanders became converts to this lethal mixture of religion and politics, a danger that the nation's founders had done their utmost to avoid. They did not want religion in the Constitution or in the government of the United States, although they weren't hostile to it, on the other hand. New England's hatred of the South permeated the abolitionists' anti-slavery speeches and pamphlets and newspaper stories. To white Southerners, this verbal abuse poisoned the call to free black men and women from bondage. No one described the impact of this disease of the public mind better than Thomas Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph. I devoted another chapter of the book to him, and it's, if I may say so, one of the best in the book. In 1833, 7 years after his grandfather's death, Jefferson, as his family called him, proposed a program of gradual emancipation in the Virginia legislature. After a furious debate in which an astonishing number of prominent Virginians admitted slavery was a curse, he lost by only 5 votes. Thomas Jefferson Randolph ran for re-election, determined to renew the struggle. He beat a prominent pro-slavery opponent who had served in the U.S. Congress. But when he got to the legislature for his second term, he got nowhere. The abolitionists had begun flooding Virginia with pamphlets and broadsides that revealed what Randolph called, many years later, their morbid hatred of the Southern white man, that blackened his character with obscene malignity. The opportunity for a rational debate about slavery had vanished beyond recall. Around this time, another man was beginning his political career in Illinois. Abraham Lincoln summed up his philosophy in words that were the total opposite of the abolitionist's approach. "If you want to win a man to your cause," Lincoln said, "first convince him that you are his sincere friend. Therein is a drop of honey that catches his heart." The abolitionists were incapable of this generosity. In 1831, a deranged slave preacher named Nat Turner called on his followers to imitate Santo Domingo and kill every white person they encountered. William Lloyd Garrison and his followers did not say a word of sympathy for the bereaved families and friends of Turner's victims. Although Garrison claimed to disapprove of violence, he came close to gloating over the carnage. Perhaps the most revealing evidence of the abolitionist's fatal flaw is the career of Theodore Dwight Weld. For a decade, this big, huge, brilliant preacher, I call him a Connecticut-born dynamo, converted tens of thousands of people in the Midwest to anti-slavery with his blazing sermons. But in the mid-1840s, he asked himself how a professed Christian, and believe me, this man was deeply sincere in that respect, how a professed Christian could preach hatred of his fellow Americans. Theodore Dwight Weld withdrew from the abolitionist crusade and never said another word against the South or Southerners. Meanwhile, William Lloyd Garrison went from extreme to extreme. He burned the Constitution in public because it tolerated slavery. He urged the North to secede from a South infested with the evil of slavery. He called for changing the name of the nation's capital because George Washington had been a slave owner who was undoubtedly now writhing in the flames of hell. Along with his violently radical opinions, he was something of an ignoramus. He didn't even know that Washington had freed his slaves. Soon, a paranoid myth called the slave power infested thousands of Northern minds. These true believers compared the South to the Antichrist. Others said it was the apocalyptic dragon of the Book of Revelations rising to strangle freedom in the North as it had extinguished it in the South. Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts summed up this fanaticism in a single sentence. "Are you for freedom or slavery?" he shouted to a Boston audience. "Are you for God or the devil?" To complete their portrait of a morally degraded South, the abolitionists insisted that slavery had bankrupted the region. Its soil was exhausted. Most of the people lived in abject poverty. Only the 6% who owned slaves were wealthy. In fact, the South was by far the richest section of the nation. 6 of the 10 wealthiest states in the American Union were Southern. One of my book's most surprising chapters is titled "The Real Uncle Tom and the Unknown South He Helped to Create." The real Tom was Josiah Henson, a Hensonist, who was as shrewd and self-confident as the fictional Tom was stupid and cringing. Henson ran his master's Maryland farm and made twice as much money as the white overseer he replaced. Henson was not some miraculous exception. An amazing percentage of the South's plantations, some people say as many as 70%, had black overseers. Many landowners had begun paying these talented men and their workers to improve their performance. When a Louisiana planter lost one of these gifted black men to an early death, he cried, "I have lost poor Levin, one of the most faithful blacks that ever lived. He has overseen the plantation nearly 3 years and has done better at it than any white man that had ever done before." Slavery was changing. It remained a monstrously unjust institution, but the seeds of American freedom were visible in many places. And I also insist in the book that we should not degrade American blacks and think they were all reduced to childlike morons because of slavery. An enormous number of these men had gifts and they were able to display them within the grip of this awful system. But at the same time, each night on the roads of the South, armed men drafted from the militia patrolled with orders to challenge every black man they met. Thomas Jefferson's nightmare remained a cancer in the South's public mind. Eliminating slavery peacefully would never have been easy or swift, but the possibility was visible until John Brown's foray made further progress impossible. Robert E. Lee lived through these firestorms of public emotion as an officer in the U.S. Army. Many people considered him George Washington's heir. His father had been Light Horse Harry Lee, the most famous cavalry leader of the Revolution. And in 1794, Washington appointed Lee command of a militia army which went over the mountains into western Pennsylvania to suppress what we now call the Whiskey Rebellion. These western counties were seriously talking about seceding from the Union because we were taxing their liquor that they raised on their farms. And so here was Lee's father had actually crushed the first attempt at secession in America. And to top it off, Colonel Lee was married to Mary Custis, Washington's great-granddaughter. It was uncanny the way history involved Lee in the quarrel over slavery. He and his wife were living in Fortress Monroe in Virginia when Nat Turner's revolt exploded only a few miles away. When his wife inherited over 100 slaves from her father with orders to eventually free them, Lee took a leave of absence from the army to help her deal with this difficult legacy. The Custis Mansion, Arlington, overlooked Washington, D.C. It still does. Many of you may have visited. The colonel's proximity there made him the panicky President Buchanan's choice to deal with John Brown at Harper's Ferry. Lee had no solution to the dilemma of slavery beyond the hope of gradual emancipation inspired by George Washington's example. As he struggled to deal with the restless, not yet freed slaves at Arlington, abolitionists published a savage smear in a Washington newspaper. They accused him of stripping a black woman slave who had run away and personally lashing her. This was a very, very big tendency of the abolitionists. They printed more lies in their newspapers than you can possibly count. In the case of John Brown, for instance, an abolitionist printed in the told in he was a reporter for the New York Tribune, which was a big abolitionist newspaper, and he described John Brown as kissing the small daughter of a black slave as he proceeded to the gallows for his execution. This was a huge propaganda success. It swept the North. It probably had a lot to do with Emerson saying that he comparing him to Jesus Christ. It never happened. It was complete fiction. And pretty soon there was a painting of John Brown kissing this little black girl. It was very creepy stuff. In fact, the newspapers of the 19th century, I did a short history of the press, were corrupted by this tradition of what they call faking it. A good story, it didn't matter whether it was true or only half true. If it got the reader's attention, they printed it most of the time. Meanwhile, the frenzy generated by John Brown split the Union. Abraham Lincoln was elected as an anti-slavery Republican president with only 40% of the vote, virtually all from the North. Within weeks, Thomas Jefferson's nightmare reigned supreme in the seven states of the Deep South. They seceded and called for the border states to join them. To everyone's amazement, the self-educated Illinois lawyer was equal to this ultimate presidential challenge. In unspoken imitation of Washington, Lincoln saw the Union as his primary concern. In fact, he had George Washington's farewell address read aloud in Congress. And in that, of course, Washington talks about almost nothing but the importance of the Union to the future happiness of America. Lincoln then stunned abolitionists by declaring that if he could save the Union without freeing a single slave, he would do it. He insisted these words did not alter his personal detestation of slavery. This was the president's guiding principle in his decision to resupply besieged Fort Sumter in Charleston's harbor. He was determined to uphold the supremacy of the Union. When the men of the Deep South opened fire, Lincoln summoned an army of 75,000 volunteers to put down a now violent rebellion. The president remained keenly aware that Virginia, the largest southern state, had not seceded, nor had its satellite state, North Carolina, nor had other border states, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, Maryland, Arkansas, Delaware. In an immensely daring move, President Lincoln offered Colonel Robert E. Lee command of this army he had summoned to suppress the rebellion. Suddenly, I was confronting one of the most dramatic and least known turning points in America's history. Winfield Scott, the general who had seen Lee in action in the Mexican War, was the current commander of the regular army. Scott was in complete agreement with the president's offer. He said Lee was worth 50,000 men. Like other southern states, Virginia had summoned a convention to decide whether or not to secede. Many people felt that the decision depended on what Colonel Lee would do. We now know this was something of an oversimplification. These people had a lot of other things on their minds. But no one can deny the potentially huge impact of Lee's response to the president's offer. In the most agonizing decision of his life, Robert E. Lee said no. The abolitionist campaign of slander and insult against Southern white men and his discovery of John Brown's six secret backers had ravaged his loyalty to the Union. He did not see how he could command an army full of men who hated Southerners. And I might add that at Arlington, just across the river from Washington, were his wife and four daughters, which was certainly, it certainly was in the back of his mind if the fear of a race war was lurking there. After two more tormented days and nights, Colonel Lee resigned from the U.S. Army and became commander of Virginia's forces. Soon Virginia joined the Confederacy. As the war began its harvest of death on both sides, Abraham Lincoln tried to save the Union without yielding to the abolitionist call for the South's destruction. He approves stern punishment for Union soldiers who abused Southern civilians. Again and again, he tried to persuade the secessionists to accept a plan of gradual emancipation in which masses would be paid for their slaves. He was obviously aware of the way this solution had prevented bloodshed in the West Indies. The abolitionists heaped unbelievable abuse on Lincoln for this policy. One of his most savage critics was the Boston aristocrat, Wendell Phillips, who regularly urged slaves to cut their masters' throats. He compared Lincoln to a brainless turtle. At one point, the president exclaimed, "I don't see how God lets that man live." Those words helped me appreciate some little understood aspects of the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln preceded it with a final offer for compensated emancipation. This was in the last week of 1862. The Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January 1st, 1863. There was not a word in the document that suggested hatred or a desire to punish the South. It was issued in the name of the president's paramount duty to save the Union. But I must add here that it infuriated and South and triggered a tremendous outbreak of the Jefferson's nightmare in their minds. There's an editorial in the Virginia paper in which they called Lincoln unbelievable names, worse than the abolitionists, and finally said, "But why bother you with all this verbiage? Let's just settle on one thing to call him, the fiend." And they were implying he was a man who was out to murder not merely Southern soldiers, but wives and children too. But let's go on to two clauses in the Emancipation Proclamation in which Lincoln confronted Thomas Jefferson's nightmare and linked his policy to the forgotten emancipator, George Washington. He urged black Americans to refrain from violence and find honest employment when they were freed. And he announced he would accept black volunteers in the Union Army. Soon, 200,000 black men were in the fight to achieve a new birth of freedom. Lincoln knew he was following George Washington's example here. In 1862, an historian named George Livermore had published a book on black participation in the American Revolution. The president gave him one of the pens with which he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, expressing his gratitude for giving him a chance to read that book. I thought my search for understanding all the aspects of the tragedy of the Civil War was almost over when I read those clauses in the proclamation. But I was wrong. I found a book that revealed the depth and intensity of Abraham Lincoln's hopes for reconciling North and South and achieving a rebirth of that fraternal affection that Washington had seen as the key to America's union. The book was a memoir entitled Impressions of Lincoln. It connected Lincoln to George Washington in an amazing way. The author was the Marquis de Chambrun, a grandson of the Marquis de Lafayette, the man who first awakened Washington to slavery's evil. And as a longtime writer of books, I call this serendipity. It happens every so often when you're researching a book. You lay your hand on something that's on the shelf of in a library. You don't even know why you did it, and you look at that. This is the one I need. And it happens so often. It's an uncanny experience. In 1865, the French government had sent Chambrun to America to try to repair the two countries' historic friendship. It had been badly strained during the war. The affable Marquis, he was just the same cheerful, likable guy that his grandfather had been. He became a favorite of Mrs. Lincoln and was a constant visitor to the White House. Then the Lincolns invited Chambrun to join them on a trip to the Union Army camp in Virginia. The trip soon included a visit to Richmond, the recently captured capital of the almost defeated Confederacy. Schambrun described Lincoln walking through the city's wrecked, littered streets while freed black men and women cried out their gratitude. As I read this story in the Marquis's memoir, my eyes swam with tears. I wondered if the forgotten emancipator, George Washington, and his adopted son, Lafayette, were there in spirit. Forgive me, but I do have certain mystical tendencies. On the trip back to Washington, D.C., President Lincoln expressed his dismay at the devastation he had seen in Richmond. For the last year and a half of the Civil War, they had been fighting what historians now call the Hard War. The South had rejected all this offers of compensated emancipation, and it was a fight to the finish, and they did very terrible things to the civilian population and to the cities and towns, too. This was the first evidence that Lincoln had seen, the wreck that Richmond had become. And he spoke of his desire to heal the terrible wounds of the war and somehow reconcile the hostile sections. As they approached the city, the Capitol's dome loomed in the distance. Mrs. Lincoln pointed to it and told her husband that he had enemies that would not let him achieve this peace of reconciliation. She was talking about the numerous abolitionist politicians in Congress who were calling for vengeance for the execution of Robert E. Lee and other Southern leaders. Enemies, Lincoln said. His lined, weary face came aglow with a smile that was tinged with sadness. He was aware of these vengeance seekers, but he was confident with the war won that he could deal with them. He shook his head and replied in words that joined hands with George Washington's vision of an American Union unstained by slavery, reunited in fraternal affection. Enemies, Lincoln said, we must never use that word again. Thank you very much. Well, I'm ready to take a few questions if you have any.
In the calculus of the disease of the public mind, where do the copperheads fit in? And who are some of the other copperheads outside of Vallandigham?
Vallandigham, yes. Well, the copperheads were a group of Northerners, a very large group, as a matter of fact, that were hostile to the Civil War. They wanted peace, and they wanted to let slavery proceed. They are a part of the story of the war. But my whole push, or as a historian, my impulse has always been to try to look beneath the surface and go as deeply as possible and find the root causes of things. And I've done this in many different books. And the Copperheads were not a cause of the war. They were a phenomenon of the war. And they certainly deserve some attention. In fact, I have written a long essay in a book called What If? It's one of three books that were published by a very talented editor named Robert Cowley, about 3 or 4 years ago. And in one of these, I described the Northwest Conspiracy, which was a huge copperhead plot to take Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan out of the war and form a Northwest Confederacy and then insist that the southern and northern halves of the country stop the war and work out a deal where we would wind up with three countries. This was a very real threat. It came very close to succeeding. But fortunately, the Union Secret Service had infiltrated the whole operation. And the day they were supposed to attack, they arrested the leaders. And this demoralized the other people. They had imported 50,000 rifles to arm their followers in the Midwestern states, and Kentucky was in this whole thing too, and it was a huge thing. But again, as I say, it was a phenomenon of the war. Certainly, a glimpse of how many people hated the war and could not bear the thought of so many men dying when they didn't truly believe that the cause was worthy. Yes?
Did the slave rebellion in the first decade of the 19th century in New Orleans have an effect on the southern disease of the public mind?
Yes, it did. I mentioned a number of other slave rebellions. I don't mention that one, but there weren't that many of them. You know, that there was only three or four after 1831. Yes, it further deepened the fear of a slave rebellion as a race war, and unfortunately. Not a few of these rebellions, particularly Nat Turner's, did have all the evidence of a race war, which I suppose you do know what a race war is. It's indiscriminate killing of anybody because he's white or anybody because he's black. And this is not really a war. It's a wild rage that just slaughters people with no particular reason beyond the anger that's been generated. So I thank you for pointing out that particular uprising. It was pretty big. It got very large. But then the problem was, as far as the slaves were concerned, in concocting a complete rebellion without the help of somebody like John Brown and 100,000 rifles was they didn't have the weapons. And in every state in the South, and in the North too, I might add, there were trained militiamen with guns, and they could call these people out on practically no notice at all. By the time John Brown finished his first night in Harper's Ferry, the hills around Harper's Ferry were full of 3,000 or 4,000 Maryland and Virginia militiamen shooting bullets into that armory, killed his two sons. It was just, Brown proved that, to go into more detail about Brown, which might interest you, there's a very good study of Brown in which a psychologist argues with good evidence, you know, he's a trained psychologist, that Brown was a manic depressive. And he had these manic ups where he thought he could do anything. And then he had these plunges into depression when his wild schemes blew up in his face. He failed at every job he ever worked at. He had business opportunities that he claimed he was going to make him $1 million. It all blew up. It constantly did. And in the year before he raided Harper's Ferry, he admitted that he frequently had wishes for death. Because that was the depression pressing down on him. But to give an example of how totally unprepared Brown was to attack Harper's Ferry, when he and a handful of his surviving band of 18 were trapped in the armory, he decided they needed food. So what could he do? He sent out for dinner to a local hotel. Here was a man who was going to free all the slaves in America. He didn't have the brains to equip his followers, there were only 18 of them, as I said, with a knapsack with some food in it. I mean, he was really kind of a pathetic figure in many ways. He didn't have the brain power to do what he envisioned he wanted to do.
So I've got a question from the internet. This is Bob in Chicago. You talked about Lincoln and his offer to pay slave owners. And how long would have it taken to free all the slaves under that plan, if you were to guess?
Yes, the plan, Lincoln, we were talking about Lincoln's plan to his last offer just before the Emancipation Proclamation. The plan called for freeing the slaves in gradual stages, groups in gradual stages over the next 40 years, and by 1890, all the slaves would be freed. The idea was, as they freed them gradually, they would have time to train them and give them skills like Washington wanted his people to have. But the key thing was Lincoln offered to pay $4 billion to the owners to free the slaves peacefully. as he put it, we're spending a lot more than that for a single year of the war, and actually we would save money if the South would accept. So that was his plan, and it was not as impractical as you'd think. It was based on what they call the New York plan of freeing slaves. New York passed a law saying every slave who reached the age of 21 at a certain date in the calendar was going to be free. So the parents of these slaves were not free, but these young slaves grew up free. And it satisfied, New York had quite a few slaves. They had 15% of the population was black in the early years of the nation. But it kept the slaves of New York contented because they sensed that the slavery was disappearing and their children were going to be free. This was the most horrible thing about the slave system. These gifted men that I described, some of the overseers, and they were in Charleston, a third of all the skilled workers, the artisans, shoemakers, and things like that, they were blacks. Many of them actually still slaves, but they lived independently. They just paid their master a cut of their profits. And so they had the brain power, but they were trapped in this system. And if the master died bankrupt, as Jefferson did, to pay the debts of the estate, they sold all the slaves, broke up families. It was agony. And so you could see why slaves would generate a lot of anger. And these talented men who were accomplishing something, as I said, within the system, that didn't mean that they liked the system or even tolerated it. Josiah Henson, the real Uncle Tom, he put together enough money to buy his freedom. And his owner said, oh, no, I said $420, but I really meant $690. The guy was just a liar. And Josiah Henson said, oh, really? And he took his wife and four children, and he headed for Canada. And that was the last anybody saw of Josiah and his family. And up in Canada, he opened a sawmill, and he made tons of money up there in Canada. He was just an entrepreneur, you know, and a marvelous man. But you can see why he wasn't going to put up with having his children go get stuck in this system. So, Lincoln's plan had possibilities if the South could have been persuaded to cooperate. Yes, we have two questions back there. The gentleman will get to you though.
How many million people lived in the United States at that time, and how many were slaves?
When the war began in 1860, there were 500,000 free blacks in the United States. And in the border states, it was amazing how many free blacks there were. In Baltimore, at that time, there were 25,000 free black men and women and only 3,000 slaves. Maryland was, you know, really full of freed slaves, and it was freeing more and more slaves each year. There's no doubt that the movement was definitely on its way to completion, or if we could allow things to evolve in that way. So I would like to say again, I hope that you'll approach the Civil War in the same spirit that I've tried to do in this book, with sympathy, but above all, with deep understanding. Thank you for listening.
One more question upstairs.
There are those who would maintain slavery was not the only and not necessarily the principal cause of the Civil War. And one of my questions has always been, how much did the desire or the ability for the North to impose tariffs upon imported goods influence Southern interest in rebellion, in the sense that they would not be forced to buy Northern goods because of the high tariffs against imported goods? Was that a factor?
The tariff was definitely a factor in the early years of the 19th century. South Carolina seceded in 1833 because they didn't think they could tolerate the high tariff that the Congress had passed. But that was settled as the next decades continued. And the tariff was not a really big problem in the last two decades before the war began. It was an irritant, no doubt about it, but I don't think it compares to the deep things that I have tried to identify in this book.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Fleming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Thomas Fleming for joining us. The book is A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War, published by DeCapo Press. You can learn more about the library, download the audio podcast, become a member, and view other archive programs by visiting us online at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Please join us next time on The Pritzker Military Library Presents.